fluttering didn't stop. It sped up. Rose shoved away her panic, fought for clarity and focus, found some. Just enough to set the turntable in motion again, even though it had become weirdly heavy. Turn world. As it did, she felt the maddening flutter in her head first diminish and then cease as the little girl was rotated back to wherever she came from. Except that's not right. And this is far too serious for you to indulge in the luxury of lying to yourself. You came to her and walked right into a trap. Why? Because in spite of all you knew, you underestimated. Rose opened her eyes, sat up, and swung her feet onto the carpet. One of them struck the empty canister and she kicked it away. The sidewinder t-shirt she had pulled on before lying down was damp. She reeked of sweat. It was a piggy smell, entirely unattractive. She looked unbelievingly at her hand, which was scraped and bruised and swelling. Her fingernails were going from purple to black, and she guessed she might lose at least two of them. "But I didn't know," she said. "There was no way I could." She hated the whine she heard in her voice. It was the voice of a querulous old woman. No way at all. She had to get out of this goddamn camper. It might be the biggest, luxiest one in the world, but right now it felt the size of a coffin. She made her way to the door, holding on to things to keep her balance. She glanced at the clock on the dashboard before she went out. 10 to 2. Everything had happened in just 20 minutes. Incredible. How much did she find out before I got free of her? How much does she know? No way of telling for sure. But even a little could be dangerous. The brat had to be taken care of. And soon. Rose stepped out into the pale early moonlight and took half a dozen long, steadying breaths of fresh air. She began to feel a little better. A little more herself. But she couldn't let go of that fluttering sensation. The feeling of having someone else inside her. A rube, no less, looking at her private things. The pain had been bad, and the surprise of being trapped that way was worse. But the worst thing of all was the humiliation and sense of violation. She had been stolen from. "You are going to pay for that. Princess, you just messed in with the wrong bitch." A shape was moving toward her. Rose had settled on the top step of her RV, but now she stood up tense, ready for anything. Then the shape got closer, and she saw it was Crow. He was dressed in pajama bottoms and slippers.
"Rose, I think you better..."
He stopped.
"What the hell happened to your hand?"
"Never mind my fucking hand," she snapped. "What are you doing here at 2 in the morning? Especially when you knew I was apt to be busy."
"It's Grandpa Flick," Crow said. "Apron Annie says he's dying."
Chapter 11. Tommy, 25. 1. Instead of pine-scented air freshener and Alcazar cigars, Grandpa Flick's Fleetwood this morning smelled of shit, disease, and death. It was also crowded. There were at least a dozen members of the True Knot present, some gathered around the old man's bed, many more sitting or standing in the living room, drinking coffee. The rest were outside. Everyone looked stunned and uneasy. The True wasn't used to death. On their own. "Clear out," Rose said. "Crow and Nut, you stay."
"Look at him," Petty the Chink said in a trembling voice. "Them spots. And he's cycling like crazy, Rose. Oh, this is horrible."
"Go on," Rose said. She spoke gently and gave Petty a comforting squeeze on the shoulder when what she felt like doing was kicking her fat cockney ass right out the door. She was a lazy gossip, good for nothing but warming Barry's bed and probably not very good at that. Rose guessed that nagging was more Petty's specialty, when she wasn't scared out of her mind, that is.
Come on, folks, Crow said. If he is going to die, he doesn't need to do it with an audience.
He'll pull through, Harpman Sam said. Tougher'n a boiled owl, that's Grandpa Flick.
But he put his arm around Baba the Russian, who looked devastated and hugged her tight against him for a moment. They got moving, some taking a last look back over their shoulders before going down the steps to join the others. When it was just the three of them, Rose approached the bed.
Grandpa Flick stared up at her without seeing her. His lips had pulled back from his gums. Great patches of his fine white hair had fallen out on the pillowcase, giving him the look of a distempered dog. His eyes were huge and wet and filled with pain. He was naked except for a pair of boxer shorts, and his scrawny body was stippled with red marks that looked like pimples or insect bites. She turned to Walnut and said, "What in hell are those?"
"Coplic spots," he said. "That's what they look like to me, anyway. Although coplics are usually just inside the mouth."
"Talk English." Nut ran his hands through his thinning hair.
"I think he's got the measles."
Rose gaped in shock, then barked laughter. She didn't want to stand here listening to this shit. She wanted some aspirin for her hand, which sent out a pain pulse with every beat of her heart. She kept thinking about how the hands of cartoon characters looked when they got whopped with a mallet. "We don't catch rube diseases."
"Well, we never used to."
She stared at him furiously. She wanted her hat. She felt naked without it, but it was back in the Earth Cruiser.
Nut said, "I can only tell you what I see, which is red measles, also known as rubeola."
A rube disease called rubeola. How too fucking perfect. That is just horseshit. He flinched, and why not? She sounded strident even to herself, but, Jesus God, measles? The oldest member of the True Knot dying of a childhood disease even children didn't catch anymore.
"That baseball-playing kid from Iowa had a few spots on him, but I never thought. Because, yeah, it's like you say, we don't catch their diseases."
"He was years ago."
"I know. All I can think is that it was in the steam, and it kind of hibernated. There are diseases that do that, you know. Lie passive, sometimes for years, then break out."
"Maybe with rubes." She kept coming back to that. Walnut only shook his head. "If Gramps got it, why don't we all have it?"
"Because those childhood diseases, chickenpox, measles, mumps, run through rube kids like shit through a goose. It doesn't make sense."
Then she turned to Crow Daddy and promptly contradicted herself.
"What the fuck were you thinking when you let a bunch of them in to stand around and breathe his air?"
Crow just shrugged, his eyes never leaving the shivering old man on the bed. Crow's narrow, handsome face was pensive.
"Things change," Nut said. "Just because we had immunity to rube diseases 50 or 100 years ago doesn't mean we have it now. For all we know, this could be part of a natural process."
"Are you telling me there's anything natural about that?" She pointed to Grandpa Flick.
"A single case doesn't make an epidemic," Nut said. "And it could be something else. But if this happens again, we'll have to put whoever it happens to in complete quarantine."
"Would it help?" He hesitated a long time.
"I don't know. Maybe we do have it, all of us. Maybe it's like an alarm clock set to go off or dynamite on a timer. According to the latest scientific thinking, that's sort of how rubes age. They go long and go long pretty much the same, then something turns off in their genes. The wrinkles start showing up, and all at once they need canes to walk with."
Crow had been watching Grandpa. "There he goes. Fuck." Grandpa Flick's skin was turning milky, then translucent. As it moved toward complete transparency, Rose could see his liver, the shriveled gray-black bags of his lungs, the pulsing red knot of his heart. She could see his veins and arteries like the highways and turnpikes on her in-dash GPS. She could see the optic nerves that connected his eyes to his brain, They looked like ghostly strings. Then he came back. His eyes moved, caught Rosie's, held them. He reached out and took her unhurt hand. Her first impulse was to pull away. If he had what Nut said he had, he was contagious. But what the hell? If Nut was right, they had all been exposed.
"Rose," he whispered, "don't leave me."
"I won't." She sat down beside him on the bed, her fingers entwined in his. "Crow." "Yes, Rose." "The package you had sent to Sturbridge. They'll hold it, won't they?"
"Sure."
"All right. We'll see this through. But we can't afford to wait too long. The little girl is a lot more dangerous than I thought." She sighed. "Why do problems always come in bunches?"
"Did she do that to your hand somehow?"
That was a question she didn't want to answer directly.
"I won't be able to go with you, because she knows me now."
Also, she thought but didn't say, "because if this is what Walnut thinks it is, the rest will need me here to play Mother Courage."
"But we have to have her. It's more important than ever."
"Because?"
"If she's had the measles, she'll have the rube immunity to catching it again. That might make her steam useful in all sorts of ways."
"The kids get vaccinated against all that crap now," Crow said. Rose nodded. "That could work, too." Grandpa Flick once more began to cycle. It was hard to watch, but Rose made herself do it. When she could no longer see the old fellow's organs through his fragile skin, she looked at Crow and held up her bruised and scraped hand.
"Also, she needs to be taught a lesson."
2. When Dan woke up in his turret room on Monday, the schedule had once more been wiped from his blackboard and replaced with a message from Abra. At the top was a smiley face. All the teeth were showing, which gave it a gleeful look.
"She came. I was ready, and I hurt her. I really did. She deserves it, so hooray! I need to talk to you, not this way or that. Same place as before, 3 p.m.
Dan lay back on his bed, covered his eyes, and went looking for her. He found her walking to school with three of her friends, which struck him as dangerous in itself, for the friends as well as for Abra. He hoped Billy was there and on the job. He also hoped Billy would be discreet and not get tagged by some zealous neighborhood watch type as a suspicious character.
"I can come. John and I don't leave until tomorrow, but it has to be fast and we have to be careful."
"Yes, okay, good."
3. Dan was once more seated on a bench outside the ivy-covered Aniston Library when Abra emerged, dressed for school in a red jumper and snazzy red sneakers. She held a knapsack by one strap. To Dan, she looked as if she'd grown an inch since the last time he'd seen her. She waved. "Hi, Uncle Dan."
"Hello, Abra. How was school?"
"Great. I got an A on my biology report."
"Sit down a minute and tell me about it."
She crossed to the bench. So filled with grace and energy, she almost seemed to dance. Eyes bright, color high, a healthy after-school teenager with all systems showing green. Everything about her said, "Ready, steady, go." There was no reason for this to make Dan feel uneasy, but it did.
One very good thing, a nondescript Ford pickup was parked half a block down, the old guy behind the wheel sipping a takeout coffee and reading a magazine. Appearing to read a magazine, at least.
"Billy?"
No answer, but he looked up from his magazine for a moment, and that was enough.
"Okay," Dan said in a lower voice. "I want to hear exactly what happened."
She told him about the trap she had set and how well it had worked. Dan listened with amazement, admiration, and that growing sense of unease. Her confidence in her abilities worried him. It was a kid's confidence, and the people they were dealing with weren't kids.
"I just told you to set an alarm," he said when she had finished.
This was better. "I don't know if I could have gone at her that way if I wasn't pretending to be Daenerys in the Game of Thrones books, but I think so. Because she killed a baseball boy and lots of others.
Also because, for the first time, her smile faltered a little. As she was telling her story, Dan had seen what she would look like at 18. Now he saw what she had looked like at 9. Because what? She's not human. None of them are. Maybe they were once, but not anymore. She straightened her shoulders and tossed her hair back. But I'm stronger. She knew it, too. I thought she pushed you away. She frowned at him, annoyed, wiped at her mouth, then caught her hand doing it and returned it to her lap. Once it was there, the other one clasped it to keep it still. There was something familiar about this gesture, but why wouldn't there be? He'd seen her do it before. Right now he had bigger things to worry about. Next time I'll be ready, if there is a next time. That might be true, but if there was a next time, the woman in the hat would be ready too. I only want you to be careful.
I will, for sure.
This, of course, was what all kids said in order to placate the adults in their lives, but it still made Dan feel better. A little, anyway. Besides, there was Billy in his F-150 with the faded red paint.
Her eyes were dancing again. I found lots of stuff out. That's why I needed to see you.
What stuff?
Not where she is. I didn't get that far. But I did find... See, when she was in my head, I was in hers. Like swapsies, you know? It was full of drawers, like being in the world's biggest library reference room. Although maybe I only saw it that way because she did. If she had been looking at computer screens in my head, I might have seen computer screens.
How many of her drawers did you get into?
3, maybe 4. They call themselves the True Knot. Most of them are old, and they really are like vampires. They look for kids like me, and like you were, I guess. Only they don't drink blood, they breathe in the stuff that comes out when the special kids die.
She winced in disgust.
The more they hurt them before, the stronger that stuff is. They call it steam.
It's red, right? Red or reddish pink? He felt sure of this, but Abra frowned and shook her head.
No, white. A bright white cloud. Nothing red about it. And listen, they can store it. What they don't use, they put in these thermos bottle thingies. But they never have enough. I saw this show once about sharks. It said they're always on the move because they never have enough to eat. I think the True Knot is like that.
She grimaced.
They're naughty, all right.
White stuff. Not red, but white. It still had to be what the old nurse had called the gasp, but a different kind, because it came from healthy young people instead of old ones dying of almost every disease the flesh was heir to. Because they were what Abra called the special kids? Both? She was nodding. Both, probably. Okay. But the thing that matters most is that they know about you. She knows.
They're a little scared I might tell someone about them, but not too scared.
Because you're just a kid and no one believes kids.
Right.
She blew her bangs off her forehead.
Momo would believe me, but she's going to die. She's going to your hot spice, Dan. Hospice, I mean. You'll help her, won't you? If you're not in Iowa?
All I can.
Abra, are they coming for you?
Maybe, but if they do, it won't be because of what I know. It will be because of what I am. Her happiness was gone now that she was facing this head on. She rubbed at her mouth again, and when she dropped her hand, her lips were parted in an angry smile. This girl has a temper, Dan thought. He could relate to that. He had a temper himself. It had gotten him in trouble more than once.
She won't come, though. That bitch. She knows I know her now, and I'll sense her if she gets close, because we're sort of tied together. But there are others. If they come for me, they'll hurt anyone who gets in their way.
Abra took his hands in hers, squeezing hard. This worried Dan, but he didn't make her let go. Right now she needed to touch someone she trusted.
We have to stop them so they can't hurt my daddy, or my mom, or any of my friends. and so they won't kill any more kids.
For a moment, Dan caught a clear picture from her thoughts, not scent, just there in the foreground. It was a collage of photos, children, dozens of them, under the heading, "Have You Seen Me?" She was wondering how many of them had been taken by the True Knot, murdered for their final psychic gasp, the obscene delicacy this bunch lived on, and left in unmarked graves.
"You have to get that baseball glove. If I have it, I'll be able to find out where Barry the Chunk is. I know I will, and the rest of them will be where he is. If you can't kill them, at least you can report them to the police. Get me that glove, Dan. Please."
"If it's where you say it is, we'll get it. But in the meantime, Abra, you have to watch yourself."
"I will."
"But I don't think she'll try sneaking into my head again." Abra's smile reemerged. In it, Dan saw the take-no-prisoners warrior woman she sometimes pretended to be. Daenerys, or whoever. "If she does, she'll be sorry." Dan decided to let this go. They had been together on this bench as long as he dared. Longer, really. "I've set up my own security system on your behalf. If you looked into me, I imagine you could find out what it is, but I don't want you to do that. If someone else from this knot tries to go prospecting in your head, not the woman in the hat, but someone else, they can't find out what you don't know."
"Oh, okay."
He could see her thinking that anyone else who tried that would be sorry, too, and this increased his sense of unease. "Just, if you get in a tight place, yell Billy with all your might, got that?"
"Yes, the way you once called for your fintech."
He jumped a little. Abra smiled.
"I wasn't peeking. I just..."
"I understand. Now tell me one thing before you go."
"What?"
"Did you really get an A on your bio report?" 4. At 7:45 on that Monday evening, Rose got a double break on her walkie. It was Crow.
"Better get over here," he said. "It's happening."
The True was standing around Grandpa's RV in a silent circle. Rose, now wearing her hat at its accustomed gravity-defying angle, cut through them, pausing to give Andy a hug, then went up the steps, rapped once, and let herself in. Nut was standing with Big Mo and Apron Annie, Grandpa's two reluctant nurses. Crow was sitting on the end of the bed. He stood up when Rose came in. He was showing his age this evening. Lines bracketed his mouth, and there were a few threads of white silk in his black hair. "We need to take steam," Rose thought, "and when this is over, we will." Grandpa Flick was cycling rapidly now, first transparent, then solid again, then transparent. But each transparency was longer, and more of him disappeared. He knew what was happening, Rose saw. His eyes were wide and terrified. His body writhed with the pain of the changes it was going through. She had always allowed herself to believe, on some deep level of her mind, in the True Knot's immortality. Yes, every 50 or 100 years or so, someone died. Like that big dumb Dutchman, hands-off Hans, who had been electrocuted by a falling power line in an Arkansas windstorm not long after World War II ended. Or Katie Patches, who had drowned. Or Tommy the Truck. But those were exceptions. Usually the ones who fell were taken down by their own carelessness. So she had always believed. Now, she saw she had been as foolish as Rube children, clinging to their belief in Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny. He cycled back to solidity, moaning and crying and shivering.
"Make it stop! Rosie, girl, make it stop. It hurts."
Before she could answer, and really what could she have said? He was fading again, until there was nothing left of him but a sketch of bones and his staring, floating eyes. They were the worst. Rose tried to contact him with her mind and comfort him that way, but there was nothing to hold on to.
where Grandpa Flick had always been, often grumpy, sometimes sweet. There was now only a roaring windstorm of broken images. Rose withdrew from him, shaken. Again she thought, this can't be happening.
Maybe we should put him out of his misery,
Big Mo said. She was digging her fingernails into Annie's forearm, but Annie didn't seem to feel it.
Give him a shot or something. You got something in your bag, don't you, Nut? You must.
What good would it do? Walnut's voice was hoarse. Maybe earlier, but it's going too fast now. He's got no system for any drug to circulate in. If I gave him hypo in the arm, we'd see it soaking into the bed 5 seconds later. Best just let it happen. It won't be long.
Nor was it. Rose counted 4 more full cycles. On the 5th, even his bones disappeared. For a moment the eyeballs remained, staring first at her, and then rolling to look at Crow Daddy. They hung above the pillow, which was still indented by the weight of his head and stained with Wild Root cream oil hair tonic, of which he seemed to have an endless supply. She thought she remembered Greedy G telling her once that he bought it on eBay. eBay, for fuck's sweet sake. Then slowly, the eyes disappeared too. Except, of course, they weren't really gone. Rose knew she'd be seeing them in her dreams later tonight. So would the others in attendance at Grandpa Flick's deathbed, if they got any sleep at all. They waited, none of them entirely convinced that the old man wouldn't appear before them again like the ghost of Hamlet's father or Jacob Marley or some other. But there was only the shape of his disappeared head, the stains left by his hair tonic, and the deflated pee and shit-stained boxers he had been wearing. Mo burst into wild sobs and buried her head in Apron Annie's generous bosom. Those waiting outside heard, and one voice, Rose would never know whose, began to speak. Another joined in, then a third, and a fourth. Soon, they were all chanting under the stars, and Rose felt a wild chill go zigzagging up her back. She reached out, found Crow's hand, and squeezed it. Annie joined in. Mo next, her words muffled. Nut, then Crow. Rose the Hat took a deep breath and added her voice to theirs. Lodesome Hanti, we are the chosen ones. Kahana, Risone, Hanti, we are the fortunate ones. Sabatha Hanti, Sabatha Hanti, Sabatha Hanti, we are the true knot, and we endure.
5.
Later, Crow joined her in her Earth cruiser.
You really won't be going east, will you?
No, you'll be in charge.
What do we do now?
Mourn him, of course. Unfortunately, we can only give him 2 days.
The traditional period was 7.
No fucking, no idle talk, no steam, just meditation. Then a circle of farewell, where everyone would step forward and say one memory of Grandpa Jonas Flick and give up one object they had from him or that they associated with him. Rose had already picked hers, a ring with a Celtic design Grandpa had given her when this part of America had still been Indian country and she had been known as the Irish Rose. There was never a body when a member of the tribe died. So the objects of remembrance had to serve the purpose. Those things were wrapped in white linen and buried.
So my group leaves when? Wednesday night or Thursday morning?
Wednesday night. Rose wanted the girl as soon as possible. Drive straight through, and you're positive they'll hold the knockout stuff at the mail drop in Sturbridge.
Yes, set your mind at ease on that.
My mind won't be at ease until I can look at that little bitch lying in the room right across from mine, drugged to the gills, handcuffed, and full of tasty, suckable steam.
Who are you taking? Name them off.
Me? Nut? Jimmy Numbers, if you can spare him.
I can spare him. Who else?
Snakebite Andy. If we need to put someone to sleep, she can get it done. And the Chink. Him for sure. He's the best locator we've got now that Grandpa's gone. Other than you, that is.
By all means take him, but you won't need a locator to find this one, Rose said. That's not going to be the problem. And just one vehicle will be enough. Take Steamhead Steve's Winnebago.
Already spoke to him about it.
She nodded, pleased. One other thing. There's a little hole-in-the-wall store in Sidewinder called District X. Crow raised his eyebrows.
The porno palace with the inflatable nurse doll in the window.
You know it, I see. Rose's tone was dry. Now listen to me, Daddy. Crow listened.
6.
Dan and John Dalton flew out of Logan on Tuesday morning just as the sun was rising. They changed planes in Memphis and touched down in Des Moines at 11:15 Central Daylight Time on a day that felt more like mid-July than late September. Dan spent the first part of the Boston to Memphis leg pretending to sleep so he wouldn't have to deal with the doubts and second thoughts he felt sprouting like weeds in John's mind. Somewhere over upstate New York, pretending ceased and he fell asleep for real. It was John who slept between Memphis and Des Moines, so that was all right. And once they were actually in Iowa, rolling toward the town of Freeman in a totally unobtrusive Ford Focus from Hertz, Dan sensed that John had put his doubts to bed. For the time being, at least. What had replaced them was curiosity and uneasy excitement. Boys on a treasure hunt, Dan said. He'd had the longer nap, and so he was behind the wheel. High corn, now more yellow than green, flowed past them on either side. John jumped a little.
Huh?
Dan smiled. Isn't that what you were thinking? That we're like boys on a treasure hunt?
You're pretty goddamn spooky, Daniel.
I suppose. I've gotten used to it. This was not precisely true.
When did you find out you could read minds?
It isn't just mind reading. The Shining's a uniquely variable talent, if it is a talent. Sometimes, lots of times, it feels more like a disfiguring birthmark. I'm sure Abra would say the same. As for when I found out, I never did. I just always had it. It came with the original equipment.
And you drank to blot it out.
A fat woodchuck trundled with leisurely fearlessness across Route 150. Dan swerved to avoid it, and the chuck disappeared into the corn, still not hurrying. It was nice out here, the sky looking 1,000 miles deep and nary a mountain in sight. New Hampshire was fine, and he'd come to think of it as home, but Dan thought he was always going to feel more comfortable in the flatlands, safer. You know better than that, Johnny. Why does any alcoholic drink?
Because he's an alcoholic.
Bingo. Simple as can be. Cut through the psychobabble and you're left with the stark truth. We drank because we're drunks. John laughed.
KCK has truly indoctrinated you.
Well, there's also the heredity thing, Dan said. Casey always kicks that part to the curb, but it's there. Did your father drink?
Him and Mother Dearest both. They could have kept the 19th hole at the country club in business all by themselves. I remember the day my mother took off her tennis dress and jumped into the pool with us kids. The men applauded. My dad thought it was a scream. Me, not so much. I was 9, and until I went to college, I was the boy with the striptease, Mommy. Yours?
My mother could take it or leave it alone. Sometimes she used to call herself Two Beers Windy. My dad, however, one glass of wine or can of Bud, and he was off to the races. Dan glanced at the odometer and saw they still had 40 miles to go. You want to hear a story? One I've never told anybody? I should warn you, it's a weird one. If you think The Shining begins and ends with paltry shit like telepathy, you're way short. He paused. There are other worlds than these.
You've...
seen these other worlds?
Dan had lost track of John's mind, but DJ suddenly looked a little nervous, as if he thought the guy sitting next to him might suddenly stick his hand in his shirt and declare himself the reincarnation of Napoleon Bonaparte.
No, just some of the people who live there. Abra calls them the ghosty people. Do you want to hear or not?
I'm not sure I do, but maybe I better.
Dan didn't know how much this New England pediatrician would believe about the winter the Torrance family had spent at the Overlook Hotel, but found he didn't particularly care. Telling it in this nondescript car, under this bright Midwestern sky, would be good enough. There was one person who would have believed it all, but Abra was too young, and the story was too scary. John Dalton would have to do. But how to begin? With Jack Torrance, he supposed. A deeply unhappy man who had failed at teaching, writing, and husbanding. What did the baseball players call three strikeouts in a row? The golden sombrero? Dan's father had had only one notable success. When the moment finally came, the one the Overlook had been pushing him toward from their first day in the hotel, he had refused to kill his little boy. If there was a fitting epitaph for him, it would be,
Dan.
My father tried, he said. That's the best I can say for him. The most malevolent spirits in his life came in bottles. If he'd tried AA, things might have been a lot different. But he didn't. I don't think my mother even knew there was such a thing, or she would have suggested he give it a shot. By the time we went up to the Overlook Hotel, where a friend of his got him a job as the winter caretaker, his picture could have been next to dry drunk in the dictionary.
That's where the ghosts were?
Yes. I saw them. He didn't, but he felt them. Maybe he had his own shining. Probably he did. Lots of things are hereditary, after all, not just a tendency toward alcoholism. And they worked on him. He thought they, the ghosty people, wanted him. But that was just another lie. What they wanted was a little boy with a great big shine. The same way this True Knot bunch wants Abra. He stopped, remembering how Dick, speaking through Eleanor Ouellet's dead mouth, had answered when Dan had asked where the empty devils were. In your childhood, where every devil comes from.
Dan, are you okay?
Yes, Dan said. Anyway, I knew something was wrong in that goddamn hotel even before I stepped through the door. I knew when the three of us were still living pretty much hand-to-mouth down in Boulder on the eastern slope. But my father needed a job so he could finish a play he was working on. 7. By the time they reached Adair, he was telling John how the Overlook's boiler had exploded and how the old hotel had burned to the ground in a driving blizzard. Adair was a two-stoplight town, but there was a Holiday Inn Express, and Dan noted the location. That's where we'll be checking in a couple of hours from now, he told John. We can't go digging for treasure in broad daylight. And besides, I'm dead for sleep. Haven't been getting much lately.
All that really happened to you? John asked in a subdued voice.
It really did, Dan smiled. Think you can believe it?
If we find the baseball glove where she says it is, I'll have to believe a lot of things. Why did you tell me?
Because part of you thinks we're crazy to be here in spite of what you know about Abra. Also because you deserve to know that there are forces. I've encountered them before, you haven't. All you've seen is a little girl who can do assorted psychic parlor tricks like hanging spoons on the ceiling. This isn't a boy's treasure hunt game, John. If the True Knot finds out what we're up to, we'll be pinned to the target right along with Abra Stone. If you decided to bail on this business, I'd make the sign of the cross in front of you and say, go with God.
And continue on by yourself.
Dan tipped him a grin. Well, there's Billy.
Billy's 73 if he's a day.
He'd say that's a plus. Billy likes to tell people that the good thing about being old is that you don't have to worry about dying young.
John pointed.
Freeman Town Line. He gave Dan a small, tight smile. I can't completely believe I'm doing this. What are you going to think if that ethanol plant is gone? If it's been torn down since Google Earth snapped its picture and planted over with corn?
It'll still be there, Dan said.
8.
And so it was. A series of soot-gray concrete blocks roofed in rusty corrugated metal. One smokestack still stood. Two others had fallen and lay on the ground like broken snakes. The windows had been smashed, and the walls were covered in blotchy spray-paint graffiti that would have been laughed at by the protaggers in any big city. A potholed service road split off from the two-lane, ending in a parking lot that had sprouted with errant seed corn. The water tower Abra had seen stood nearby, rearing against the horizon like an H.G. Wells Martian war machine. Freeman, Iowa was printed on the side. The shed with the broken roof was also present and accounted for. Satisfied? Dan asked. They had slowed to a crawl. Factory, water tower, shed, no trespassing sign, all just like she said it would be. John pointed to the rusty gate at the end of the service road.
What if that's locked? I haven't climbed a chain-link fence since I was in junior high.
It wasn't locked when the killers brought that kid here, or Abra would have said.
Are you sure of that?
A farm truck was coming the other way. Dan sped up a little and lifted a hand as they passed. The guy behind the wheel, green John Deere cap, sunglasses, bib overalls, raised his in return but hardly glanced at them. That was a good thing.
I asked if...
I know what you asked, Dan said. If it's locked, we'll deal with it. Somehow. Now let's go back to that motel and check in. I'm whipped.
9.
While John got adjoining rooms at the Holiday Inn, paying cash, Dan sought out the Adair True Value Hardware. He bought a spade, a rake, two hoes, a garden trowel, two pairs of gloves, and a duffel to hold his new purchases. The only tool he actually wanted was the spade, but it seemed best to buy in bulk.
"What brings you to Adair, may I ask?"
the clerk asked as he rang up Dan's stuff. "Just passing through. My sister's in Des Moines, and she's got quite the garden patch. She probably owns most of this stuff, but presents always seem to improve her hospitality."
"I hear that, brother, and she'll thank you for this short-handle hoe. No tool comes in handier. And most amateur gardeners never think to get one. We take MasterCard, Visa."
"I think I'll give the plastic a rest," Dan said, taking out his wallet. "Just give me a receipt for Uncle Sugar."
"You bet. And if you give me your name and address, or your sister's, we'll send our catalog."
"You know what? I'm going to pass on that today," Dan said, and put a little fan of 20s on the counter.
10.
At 11 o'clock that night, there came a soft rap on Dan's door. He opened it and let John inside. Abra's pediatrician was pale and keyed up.
"Did you sleep?"
"Some," Dan said. "You?"
"In and out, mostly out. I'm nervous as a goddamn cat. If a cop stops us, what are we going to say?"
"That we heard there was a juke joint in Freeman and decided to go looking for it."
"There's nothing in Freeman but corn. About 9 billion acres of it."
"We don't know that," Dan said mildly. "We're just passing through. Besides, no cop's going to stop us, John. Nobody's even going to notice us. But if you want to stay here..."
"I didn't come halfway across the country to sit in a motel watching Jay Leno. Just let me use the toilet. I used mine before I left the room, but now I need to go again. Christ, am I nervous."
The drive to Freeman seemed very long to Dan. But once they left Adair behind, they didn't meet a single car. Farmers went to bed early, and they were off the trucking routes. When they reached the ethanol plant, Dan doused the rental car's lights, turned into the service road, and rolled slowly up to the closed gate. The two men got out. John cursed when the Ford's dome light came on. "I should have turned that thing off before we left the motel, or smashed the bulb if it doesn't have a switch." "Relax," Dan said. "There's no one out here but us chickens." Still, his heart was beating hard in his chest as they walked to the gate. If Abra was right,
A little boy had been murdered and buried out here after being miserably tortured. If ever a place should be haunted. John tried the gate, and when pushing didn't work, he tried pulling.
Nothing. What now? Climb, I guess. I'm willing to try, but I'll probably break my fucking...
Wait. Dan took a penlight from his jacket pocket and shone it on the gate, first noting the broken padlock, then the heavy twists of wire above and below it. He went back to the car, and it was his turn to wince when the trunk light came on. Well, shit. He couldn't think of everything. He yanked out the new duffel and slammed the trunk lid down. Dark returned. Here, he told John, holding out a pair of gloves. Put these on. Dan put on his own, untwisted the wire, and hung both pieces in one of the chain-link diamonds for later reference. Okay, let's go.
I have to pee again.
Oh, man, hold it.
11. Dan drove the Hertz Ford slowly and carefully around to the loading dock. There were plenty of potholes, some deep, all hard to see with the headlights off. The last thing in the world he wanted was to drop the Focus into one and smash an axle. Behind the plant, the surface was a mixture of bare earth and crumbling asphalt. 50 feet away was another chain-link fence, and beyond that, endless leagues of corn. The dock area wasn't as big as the parking lot, but it was plenty big.
Dan, how will we know where? Be quiet.
Dan bent his head until his brow touched the steering wheel and closed his eyes.
Abra?
Nothing. She was asleep, of course. Back in Anniston, it was already Wednesday morning. John sat beside him, chewing his lips.
Abra?
A faint stirring. It could have been his imagination. Dan hoped it was more.
Abra!
Eyes opened in his head. There was a moment of disorientation, a kind of double vision, and then Abra was looking with him. The loading dock and the crumbled remains of the smokestacks were suddenly clearer, even though there was only starlight to see by. Her vision's a hell of a lot better than mine. Dan got out of the car. So did John, but Dan barely noticed. He had ceded control to the girl who was now lying awake in her bed 1,100 miles away. He felt like a human metal detector. Only it wasn't metal that they were looking for.
Walk over to that concrete thing.
Dan walked to the loading dock and stood with his back to it.
Now start going back and forth.
A pause as she hunted for a way to clarify what she wanted.
Like on CSI.
He coursed 50 feet or so to the left, then turned right, moving out from the dock on opposing diagonals. John had gotten the spade out of the duffel bag and stood by the rental car watching.
Here's where they park their RVs.
Dan cut back left again, walking slowly, occasionally kicking a loose brick or chunk of concrete out of his way.
You're close.
Dan stopped. He smelled something unpleasant, a gassy whiff of decay.
Abra, do you? Yes. Oh, God, Dan.
Take it easy, hun.
You went too far. Turn around. Go slow.
Dan turned on one heel like a soldier doing a sloppy about face. He started back toward the loading dock.
Left a little to your left, slower.
He went that way, now pausing after each small step. Here was that smell again, a little stronger. Suddenly the preternaturally sharp nighttime world began to blur as his eyes filled with Abra's tears.
There, the baseball boy, you're standing right on top of it.
Dan took a deep breath and wiped at his cheeks. He was shivering, not because he was cold, but because she was. Sitting up in her bed, clutching her lumpy stuffed rabbit and shaking like an old leaf on a dead tree.
Get out of here, Abra. Dan, are you?
Yes, fine, but you don't need to see this. Suddenly that absolute clarity of vision was gone. Abra had broken the connection, and that was good.
Dan, John called low. all right?
Yes. His voice was still clogged with Abra's tears. Bring that spade.
12. It took them 20 minutes. Dan dug for the first 10, then passed the spade to John, who actually found Brad Trevor. He turned away from the hole covering his mouth and nose. His words were muffled but understandable.
Okay, there's a body. Jesus.
You didn't smell it before?
Buried that deep and after 2 years? Are you saying that you did?
Dan didn't reply, so John addressed the hole again, but without conviction this time. He stood for a few seconds with his back bent as if he still meant to use the spade, then straightened and drew back when Dan shone the pinlight into the little excavation they had made.
I can't, he said. I thought I could, but I can't. Not with that. My arms feel like rubber.
Dan handed him the light. John shone it into the hole, centering the beam on what had freaked him out. A dirt-clotted sneaker. Working slowly, not wanting to disturb the earthly remains of Abra's baseball boy any more than necessary, Dan scraped dirt away from the sides of the body. Little by little, an earth-covered shape emerged. It reminded him of the carvings on sarcophagi he had seen in National Geographic. The smell of decay was now very strong. Dan stepped away and hyperventilated, ending with the deepest breath he could manage. Then he dropped into the end of the shallow grave, where both of Brad Trevor's sneakers now protruded in a V. He knee-walked up to about where he thought the boy's waist must be, then held up a hand for the penlight. John handed it over and turned away. He was sobbing audibly. Dan clamped the slim flashlight between his lips and began brushing away more dirt. A child's T-shirt came into view, clinging to a sunken chest. Then hands. The fingers, now little more than bones wrapped in yellow skin, were clasped over something. Dan's chest was starting to pound for air now, but he pried the Trevor boy's fingers apart as gently as he could. Still, one of them snapped with a dry, crunching sound. They had buried him holding his baseball glove to his chest. Its lovingly oiled pocket was full of squirming bugs. The air escaped Dan's lungs in a shocked whoosh, and the breath he inhaled to replace it was rich with rot. He lunged out of the grave to his right, managing to vomit on the dirt they'd taken out of the hole instead of on the wasted remains of Bradley Trevor, whose only crime had been to be born with something a tribe of monsters wanted and had stolen from him on the very wind of his dying shrieks.
13. They reburied the body, John doing most of the work this time, and covered the spot with a makeshift crypt of broken asphalt chunks. Neither of them wanted to think of foxes or stray dogs feasting on what scant meat was left. When they were done, they got back into the car and sat without speaking. At last, John said, "What are we going to do about him, Dano? We can't just leave him. He's got parents, grandparents, probably brothers and sisters. All of them still wondering."
"He has to stay a while. Long enough so nobody's going to say, 'Gee, that anonymous call came in just after some stranger bought a spade in the Adair hardware store.' That probably wouldn't happen, but we can't take the chance."
"How long's a while?"
"Maybe a month."
John considered this, then sighed. "Maybe even two. Give his folks that long to go on thinking he might just have run off. Give them that long before we break their hearts." He shook his head. "If I'd had to look at his face, I don't think I ever could have slept again."
"You'd be surprised what a person can live with," Dan said. He was thinking of Mrs. Massey, now safely stored away in the back of his head, her haunting days over. He started the car, powered down his window, and beat the baseball glove several times against the door to dislodge the dirt. Then he put it on, sliding his fingers into the places where the child's had been on so many sunlit afternoons. He closed his eyes. After 30 seconds or so, he opened them again.
"Anything?"
You're Barry. You're one of the good guys.
What does that mean?
I don't know, except I'm betting he's the one Abra calls Barry the Chunk.
Nothing else?
Abra will be able to get more.
Are you sure of that?
Dan thought of the way his vision had sharpened when Abra opened her eyes inside his head.
I am.
Shine your light on the pocket of the glove for a sec, will you? There's something written there.
John did it, revealing a child's careful printing.
Tomi 2-5.
What does that mean? John asked. I thought his name was Trevor.
Jim Tomey's a baseball player. His number is 25. He stared into the pocket of the glove for a moment, then laid it gently on the seat between them. He was a kid's favorite major leaguer. He named his glove after him. I'm gonna get these fuckers. I swear before God Almighty, I'm going to get them and make them sorry.
14.
Rose the Hat shone. The entire true shone, but not in the way Dan or Billy did. Neither Rose nor Crow had any sense, as they said their goodbyes, that the child they had taken years ago in Iowa was at that moment being uncovered by two men who knew far too much about them already. Rose could have caught the communications flying between Dan and Abra if she had been in a state of deep meditation, but of course then the little girl would have noticed her presence immediately. Besides, the goodbyes going on in Rose's Earth Cruiser that night were of an especially intimate sort. She lay with her fingers laced together behind her head and watched Crow dress.
You visited that store, right?
District X.
Not me personally. I have a reputation to protect. I sent Jimmy numbers. Crow grinned as he buckled his belt. He could have gotten what we needed in 15 minutes, but he was gone for 2 hours. I think Jimmy's found a new home.
Well, that's good. I hope you boys enjoy yourselves. Trying to keep it light, but after 2 days of mourning, Grandpa Flick, climaxed by the circle of farewell, keeping anything light was an effort.
He didn't get anything that compares to you.
She raised her eyebrows. Had a preview, did you, Henry?
Didn't need one.
He eyed her as she lay naked with her hair spread out in a dark fan. She was tall, even lying down. He had ever liked tall women.
You're the feature attraction in my home theater, and always will be.
Overblown. Just a bit of Crow's patented razzle-dazzle, but it pleased her just the same. She got up and pressed against him, her hands in his hair. Be careful. Bring everyone back. And bring her.
We will.
Then you better get a wiggle on.
Relax. We'll be in Sturbridge when Easy Mail Services opens on Friday morning. In New Hampshire by noon. By then, Barry will have located her.
As long as she doesn't locate him.
I'm not worried about that.
Fine, Rose thought. I'll worry for both of us. I'll worry until I'm looking at her wearing cuffs on her wrists and clamps on her ankles.
The beauty of it, Crow said, is that if she does sense us and tries to put up an interference wall, Barry will key on that.
If she's scared enough, she might go to the police.
He flashed a grin. You think? Yes, little girl, they'd say. We're sure these awful people are after you. So tell us if they're from outer space or just your ordinary garden variety zombies. That way we'll know what to look for.
Don't joke. And don't take this lightly. Get in clean and get out the same way. That's how it has to be. No outsiders involved. No innocent bystanders. Kill the parents if you need to. Kill anyone who tries to interfere. But keep it quiet.
Crow snapped off a comic salute. Yes, my captain.
Get out of here, idiot. But give me another kiss first. Maybe a little of that. Educated tongue, for good measure.
He gave her what she asked for.
Rose held him tight, and for a long time.
15. Dan and John rode in silence most of the way back to the motel in Adair. The spade was in the trunk. The baseball glove was in the back seat wrapped in a Holiday Inn towel. At last John said,
"We've got to bring Abra's folks into this now. She's going to hate it, and Lucy and David won't want to believe it, but it has to be done."
Dan looked at him straight-faced and said,
"What are you, a mind reader?"
John wasn't, but Abra was, and her sudden loud voice in Dan's head made him glad that this time John was driving. If he had been behind the wheel, they very likely would have ended up in some farmer's corn patch.
"No!"
"Abra," he spoke aloud so that John could hear at least his half of the conversation. "Abra, listen to me."
"No, Dan! They think I'm all right! They think I'm almost normal now!"
"Honey, if these people had to kill your mom and dad to get to you, do you think they'd hesitate?"
"I sure don't.
Not after what we found back there." There was no counter-argument she could make to this, and Abra didn't try. But suddenly Dan's head was filled with her sorrow and her fear. His eyes welled up again and spilled tears down his cheeks. Shit. 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 Shit.
16. Early Thursday morning. Steamhead Steve's Winnebago, with Snakebite Andy currently behind the wheel, was cruising eastbound on I-80 in western Nebraska at a perfectly legal 65 miles an hour. The first streaks of dawn had just begun to show on the horizon. In Anniston, it was 2 hours later. Dave Stone was in his bathrobe, making coffee when the phone rang. It was Lucy, calling from Conchetta's Marlborough Street condo. She sounded like a woman who had nearly reached the end of her resources.
"If nothing changes for the worse, although I guess that's the only way things can change now. They'll be releasing Momo from the hospital first thing next week. I talked with the two doctors on her case last night."
"Why didn't you call me, sweetheart?"
"Too tired and too depressed. I thought I'd feel better after a night's sleep, but I didn't get much. Honey, this place is just so full of her. Not just her work, her vitality."
Her voice wavered. David waited. They had been together for over 15 years, and he knew that when Lucy was upset, waiting was sometimes better than talking.
"I don't know what we're going to do with it all. Just looking at the books makes me tired. There are thousands on the shelves and stacked in her study, and the super says there are thousands more in storage."
"We don't have to decide right now."
"He says there's also a trunk marked Alessandra. That was my mother's real name, you know. Although I guess she always called herself Sandra or Sandy. I never knew Momo had her stuff."
For someone who let it all hang out in her poetry, Chetta could be one closed-mouthed lady when she wanted to.
Lucy seemed not to hear him, only continued in the same dull, slightly nagging, tired-to-death tone. "Everything's arranged. Although I'll have to reschedule the private ambulance if they decide to let her go Sunday. They said they might. Thank God she's got good insurance. That goes back to her teaching days at Tufts, you know. She never made a dime from poetry. Who in this fucked-up country would pay a dime to read it anymore?"
"Lucy?"
"She's got a good place in the main building at Rivington House. A little suite. I took the online tour. Not that she'll be using it long. I made friends with the head nurse on her floor here, and she says Momo's just about at the end of her.
Chia, I love you, honey."
That, Conchetta's old nickname for her, finally stopped her. "With all my admittedly non-Italian heart and soul." "I know, and thank God you do. This has been so hard, but it's almost over. I'll be there Monday at the very latest."
"We can't wait to see you."
"How are you? How's Abra?"
"We're both fine."
David would be allowed to go on believing this for another 60 seconds or so. He heard Lucy yawn. "I might go back to bed for an hour or two. I think I can sleep now.
You do that. I've got to get Abs up for school.
They said their goodbyes, and when Dave turned away from the kitchen wall phone, he saw that Abra was already up. She was still in her pajamas. Her hair was every which way, her eyes were red, and her face was pale. She was clutching Hoppy, her old stuffed rabbit.
Abadou? Honey? Are you sick?
Yes. No. I don't know. But you will be when you hear what I'm going to tell you.
I need to talk to you, Daddy. And I don't want to go to school today. Tomorrow either. Maybe not for a while, she hesitated. I'm in trouble.
The first thing that phrase brought to mind was so awful that he pushed it away at once, but not before Abra caught it.
She smiled wanly. No, I'm not pregnant.
He stopped on his way to her, halfway across the kitchen, his mouth falling open. Did you just...
Yes, she said. I just read your mind. Although anyone could have guessed what you were thinking that time, Daddy. It was all over your face. And it's called shining, not mind reading. I can still do most of the things that used to scare you when I was little. Not all, but most.
He spoke very slowly. I know you still sometimes have premonitions. Your mom and I both know.
It's a lot more than that. I have a friend. His name is Dan. He and Dr. John have been in Iowa.
John Dalton?
Yes.
Who's this Dan? Is he a kid Dr. John treats?
No, he's a grown-up.
She took his hand and led him to the kitchen table. There they sat down, Abra still holding Hoppy.
But when he was a kid, he was like me.
Abs, I'm not understanding any of this.
There are bad people, Daddy.
She knew she couldn't tell him they were more than people, worse than people, until Dan and John were here to help her explain.
They might want to hurt me.
Why would anyone want to hurt you? You're not making sense. As for all those things you used to do, if you could still do them, we'd know. The drawer below the hanging pots flew open, then shut, then opened again. She could no longer lift the spoons, but the drawer was enough to get his attention.
Once I understood how much it worried you guys, how much it scared you, I hid it. But I can't hide it anymore. Dan says I have to tell.
She pressed her face against Hoppy's threadbare fur and began to cry. Chapter 12. They Call It Steam. 1. John turned on his cell as soon as he and Dan emerged from the jetway at Logan Airport late Thursday afternoon. He had no more than registered the fact that he had well over a dozen missed calls when the phone rang in his hand. He glanced down at the window. Stone? Dan asked.
I've got a lot of missed calls from the same number, so I'd say it has to be.
Don't answer. Call him back when we're on the expressway north and tell him we'll be there by... Dan glanced at his watch, which he had never changed from Eastern time. By 6. When we get there, we'll tell him everything.
John reluctantly pocketed his cell. I spent the flight back hoping I'm not going to lose my license to practice over this. Now I'm just hoping the cops don't grab us as soon as we park in front of Dave Stone's house.
Dan, who had consulted several times with Abra on their way back across the country, shook his head. She's convinced him to wait, but there's a lot going on in that family just now, and Mr. Stone is one confused American. To this, John offered a smile of singular bleakness.
He's not the only one.
2. Abra was sitting on the front step with her father when Dan swung into the Stones' driveway. They had made good time. It was only 5:30. Abra was up before Dave could grab her and came running down the walk with her hair flying out behind her. Dan saw she was heading for him and handed the towel-wrapped fielder's mitt to John. She threw herself into his arms. She was trembling all over.
You found him, you found him, and you found the glove. Give it to me.
Not yet, Dan said, setting her down. We need to thrash this out with your dad first.
"Thrash what out?" Dave asked. He took Abra by the wrist and pulled her away from Dan. "Who are these bad people she's talking about? And who the hell are you?"
His gaze shifted to John, and there was nothing friendly in his eyes.
"What in the name of sweet Jesus is going on here?"
"This is Dan, Daddy. He's like me. I told you."
John said, "Where's Lucy? Does she know about this?" "I'm not telling you anything until I find out what's going on."
Abra said, "She's still in Boston with Momo. Daddy wanted to call her, but I persuaded him to wait until you got here."
Her eyes remained pinned on the towel-wrapped glove. "Dan Torrance," Dave said. "That's your name?"
"Yes."
"You work at the hospice in Fraser?"
"That's right."
"How long have you been meeting my daughter?"
His hands were clenching and unclenching.
"Did you meet her on the internet? I'm betting that's it."
He switched his gaze to John.
"If you hadn't been Abra's pediatrician from the day she was born, I would have called the police 6 hours ago when you didn't answer your phone."
"I was in an airplane," John said. "I couldn't."
"Mr. Stone," Dan said, "I haven't known your daughter as long as John has, but almost. The first time I met her, she was just a baby, and it was she who reached out to me."
Dave shook his head. He looked perplexed, angry, and little inclined to believe anything Dan told him.
"Let's go in the house," John said. "I think we can explain everything. Almost everything. And if that's the case, you'll be very happy that we're here, and that we went to Iowa to do what we did."
"I damn well hope so, John. But I've got my doubts."
They went inside, Dave with his arm around Abra's shoulders. At that moment, they looked more like jailer and prisoner than father and daughter. John Dalton next, Dan last. He looked across the street at the rusty red pickup parked there. Billy gave him a quick thumbs up, then crossed his fingers. Dan returned the gesture and followed the others through the front door.
3.
As Dave was sitting down in his Richland Court living room with his puzzling daughter and his even more puzzling guests, the Winnebago containing the true raiding party was southeast of Toledo. Walnut was at the wheel. Andy Steiner and Barry were sleeping, Andy like the dead, Barry rolling from side to side and muttering. Crow was in the parlor area, paging through the New Yorker. The only things he really liked were the cartoons and the tiny ads for weird items like yak fur sweaters, Vietnamese coolie hats, and faux Cuban cigars. Jimmy Numbers plunked down next to him with his laptop in hand.
"I've been combing the net. Had the hack in back with a couple of sites, but can I show you something?"
"How can you surf the net from an interstate highway?"
Jimmy gave him a patronizing smile.
4G connection, baby. This is the modern age."
"If you say so." Crow put his magazine aside. "What have you got?"
"School pictures from Anniston Middle School."
Jimmy tapped the touchpad and a photo appeared. No grainy newsprint job, but a high-res school portrait of a girl in a red dress with puffed sleeves. Her braided hair was chestnut brown, her smile wide and confident.
"Julianne Cross," Jimmy said.
He tapped the touchpad again and a redhead with a mischievous grin popped up.
"Emma Dean."
Another tap, and an even prettier girl appeared. Blue eyes, blonde hair framing her face and spilling over her shoulders. Serious expression, but dimples hinting at a smile.
"This one's Abra Stone."
"Abra?"
"Yeah, they name them anything these days. Remember when Jane and Mabel used to be good enough for the Rubes? I read somewhere that Sly Stallone named his kid Sage Moonblood. How fucked up is that?"
"You think one of these three is Rose's girl?"
"If she's right about the girl being a young teenager, it just about has to be. Probably Dean or Stone. They're the two who actually live on the street where the little earthquake was, but you can't count the Cross girl out completely. She's just around the corner.
Jimmy Numbers made a swirling gesture on the touchpad, and the three pictures zipped into a row. Written below each in curly script was, "My School Memories." Crow studied them.
"Is anyone going to tip to the fact that you've been filching pictures of little girls off of Facebook or something? Because that sets off all kinds of warning bells in Rubeland."
Jimmy looked offended.
"Facebook, my ass! These came from the Fraser Middle School files, pipelined direct from their computer to mine."
He made an unlovely sucking sound.
"And guess what? A guy with access to a whole bank of NSA computers couldn't follow my tracks on this one. Who rocks?"
"You do," Crow said, "I guess."
"Which one do you think it is?"
"If I had to pick..." Crow tapped Abra's picture. "She's got a certain look in her eyes.
A steamy look."
Jimmy puzzled over this for a moment, decided it was dirty and guffawed.
"Does it help?"
"Yes. Can you print these pictures and make sure the others have copies? Particularly Barry. He's locator-in-chief on this one."
"I'll do it right now. I'm packing a Fujitsu scan snap. Great little on-the-go machine. I used to have the S-1100, but I swapped it when I read in Computer World."
"Just do it, okay?"
"Sure."
Crow picked up the magazine again and turned to the cartoon on the last page, the one where you were supposed to fill in the caption. This week's showed an elderly woman walking into a bar with a bear on a chain. She had her mouth open, so the caption had to be her dialogue. Crow considered carefully, then printed, "Okay, which one of you assholes called me a cunt?" Probably not a winner. The Winnebago rolled on through the deepening evening. In the cockpit, Nut turned on the headlights. In one of the bunks, Barry the Chink turned and scratched at his wrist in his sleep. A red spot had appeared there.
4. The three men sat in silence while Abra went upstairs to get something in her room. Dave thought of suggesting coffee. They looked tired, and both men needed a shave, but decided he wasn't going to offer either of them so much as a dry saltine until he got an explanation. He and Lucy had discussed what they were going to do when Abra came home someday in the not-too-distant future and announced that a boy had asked her out, but these were men. Men! And it seemed that the one he didn't know had been dating his daughter for quite some time. After a fashion, anyway. And wasn't that really the question? What sort of fashion?
Before any of them could risk starting a conversation that was bound to be awkward and perhaps acrimonious, there came the muted thunder of Abra's sneakers on the stairs. She came into the room with a copy of The Anniston Shopper. "Look at the back page."
Dave turned the newspaper over and grimaced.
"What's this brown dreck?"
"Dried coffee grounds. I threw the newspaper in the trash, but I couldn't stop thinking about it, so I fished it out again. I couldn't stop thinking about him."
She pointed to the picture of Bradley Trevor in the bottom row.
"And his parents. And his brothers and sisters, if he had them."
Her eyes filled with tears.
"He had freckles, Daddy. He hated them. But his mother said they were good luck."
"You can't know that," Dave said with no conviction at all.
"She knows," John said, "and so do you. Get with us on this, Dave. Please, it's important."
"I want to know about you and my daughter," Dave said to Dan. "Tell me about that."
Dan went through it again, doodling Abra's name in his AA meeting book, the first chalked hello. His clear sense of Abra's presence on the night Charlie Hayes died. "I asked if she was the little girl who sometimes wrote on my blackboard. She didn't answer in words, but there was a little run of piano music. Some old Beatles tune, I think."
Dave looked at John. "You told him about that?"
John shook his head.
Dan said, 2 years ago I got a blackboard message from her that said, 'They are killing the baseball boy.' I didn't know what it meant, and I'm not sure Abra did either. That might have been the end of it, but then she saw that.
He pointed to the back page of the Aniston Shopper with all those postage stamp portraits. Abra told the rest. When she was done, Dave said,
"So you flew to Iowa on a 13-year-old girl's say-so?"
"A very special 13-year-old girl," John said, "with some very special talents."
"We thought all that was over," Dave shot Abra an accusing look. "Except for a few little premonitions, we thought she outgrew it."
"I'm sorry, Daddy."
Her voice was little more than a whisper.
"Maybe she shouldn't have to be sorry," Dan said, hoping he didn't sound as angry as he felt.
"She hid her ability because she knew you and your wife wanted it to be gone. She hid it because she loves you and wanted to be a good daughter."
"She told you that, I suppose?"
"We never even discussed it," Dan said. "But I had a mother I loved dearly, and because I did the same thing."
Abra shot him a look of naked gratitude. As she lowered her eyes again, she sent him a thought, something she was embarrassed to say out loud.
She also didn't want her friends to know. She thought they wouldn't like her anymore, that they'd be scared of her. She was probably right about that, too.
"Well, let's not lose sight of the major issue," John said. "We flew to Iowa, yes. We found the ethanol plant in the town of Freeman, just where Abra said it would be. We found the boy's body and his glove. He wrote the name of his favorite baseball player in the pocket, but his name, Brad Trevor, is written on the strap."
"He was murdered.
That's what you're saying. By a bunch of wandering lunatics."
"They ride in campers and Winnebagos," Abra said. Her voice was low and dreamy. She was looking at the towel-wrapped baseball glove as she spoke. She was afraid of it, and she wanted to put her hands on it. These conflicting emotions came through to Dan so clearly that they made him feel sick to his stomach. "They have funny names, like pirate names."
Almost plaintively, Dave asked, "Are you sure the kid was murdered?"
"The woman in the hat licked his blood off her hands," Abra said. She had been sitting on the stairs. Now she went to her father and put her face against his chest. "When she wants it, she has a special tooth. All of them do."
"This kid was really like you?"
"Yes." Abra's voice was muffled but understandable. "He could see through his hand."
"What does that mean?"
"Like when certain pitches would come, he could hit them because his hand saw them first. And when his mother lost something, he'd put his hand over his eyes and look through it to see where the thing was. I think. I don't know that part for sure, but sometimes I use my hand that way."
"And that's why they killed him?" "I'm sure of it," Dan said.
"For what? Some kind of ESP vitamin? Do you know how ridiculous that sounds?"
No one replied.
"And they know Abra's on to them?"
"They know."
She raised her head. Her cheeks were flushed and wet with tears.
"They don't know my name or where I live, but they know there is a me."
"Then we need to go to the police," Dave said. "Or maybe, I guess we'd want the FBI in a case like this. They might have trouble believing it at first, but if the body's there..."
Dan said, "I won't tell you that's a bad idea until we see what Abra can do with the baseball glove, but you need to think pretty carefully about the consequences for me, for John, for you and your wife, and most of all, for Abra."
"I don't see what kind of trouble you and John could possibly..."
John shifted impatiently in his chair. "Come on, David. Who found the body? Who dug it up and then buried it again after taking a piece of evidence the forensics people would no doubt consider vital? Who brought that piece of evidence halfway across the country so an eighth grader could use it like a Ouija board?"
Although he hadn't meant to, Dan joined in. They were ganging up, and in other circumstances he might have felt bad about that, but not in these.
"Your family's already in crisis, Mr. Stone. Your grandmother-in-law is dying. Your wife's grieving and exhausted. This thing will hit the newspapers and the internet like a bomb. Wandering clan of murderers versus a supposedly psychic little girl. They'll want her on TV. You'll say no, and that will just make them hungrier.
Your street will turn into an open-air studio. Nancy Grace will probably move in next door. And in a week or two, the whole media mob will be yelling hoax at the top of its lungs. Remember Balloon Boy, Dad? That's apt to be you. Meanwhile, these folks will still be out there.
So who's supposed to protect my little girl if they come after her? You two? A doctor and a hospice orderly? Or are you just a janitor?
You don't even know about the 73-year-old groundskeeper standing watch down the street, Dan thought and had to smile. I'm a little of both. Look, Mr. Stone, seeing as how you and my daughter are great pals, I guess you better call me Dave. Okay, Dave it is. I guess what you do next depends on whether or not you're willing to gamble on law enforcement believing her, especially when she tells them that the Winnebago people are life-sucking vampires.
Christ, Dave said. I can't tell Lucy about this. She'll blow a fuse. All her fuses.
That would seem to answer the question about whether or not to call the police, John remarked. There was silence for a moment. Somewhere in the house a clock was ticking. Somewhere outside a dog was barking.
The earthquake, Dave said suddenly. That little earthquake. Was that you, Abby?
I'm pretty sure, she whispered. Dave hugged her, then stood up and took the towel off the baseball glove. He held it, looking it over.
They buried him with it, he said. They abducted him, tortured him, murdered him, and then buried him with his baseball glove.
Yes, Dan said. Dave turned to his daughter. Do you really want to touch this thing, Abra? She held out her hands and said, No, but give it to me anyway.
5.
David Stone hesitated, then handed it over. Abra took it in her hands and looked into the pocket.
Jim told me, she said,
and although Dan would have been willing to bet his savings, after 12 years of steady work and steady sobriety, he actually had some, that she had never encountered the name before, she said it correctly.
Tommy. He's in the 600 Club.
That's right, Dave said. He...
Hush. Dan said.
They watched her. She raised the glove to her face and sniffed the pocket. Dan, remembering the bugs, had to restrain a wince. She said,
Not Barry the Chunk. Barry the Chink. Only he's not Chinese. They call him that because his eyes slant up at the corners. He's there... There... I don't know... Wait. She held the glove to her chest like a baby. She began to breathe faster. Her mouth dropped open, and she moaned. Dave, alarmed, put a hand on her shoulder. Abra shook him off. No, Daddy, no! She closed her eyes and hugged the glove. They waited. At last her eyes opened, and she said, They're coming for me. Dan got up, knelt beside her, and put one hand over both of hers.
How many is it, some, or is it all of them?
Just some. Barry's with them. That's why I can see. There are 3 others. Maybe 4. One is a lady with a snake tattoo. They call us rubes. We're rubes to them.
Is the woman with the hat?
No.
When will they get here? John asked. Do you know?
Tomorrow. They have to stop first and get... She paused. Her eyes searched the room, not seeing it.
One hand slipped out from beneath Dan's and began to rub her mouth. The other clasped the glove.
They have to... I don't know.
Tears began to ooze from the corners of her eyes, not of sadness, but of effort.
Is it... medicine? Is it... Wait, wait, let go of me, Dan. I have to... You have to let me...
He took his hand away. There was a brisk snap and a blue flick of static electricity. The piano played a discordant run of notes. On an occasional table by the door to the hall, a number of ceramic Hummel figures were jittering and rapping. Abra slipped the glove on her hand. Her eyes flew wide open. One is a crow. One is a doctor. And that's lucky for them because Barry is sick. He's sick. She stared around at them wildly, then laughed. The sound of it made Dan's neck hairs stiffen. He thought it was the way lunatics must laugh when their medication is late. It was all he could do not to snatch the glove off her hand. He's got the measles.
He's got the measles from Grandpa Flick, and he'll start to cycle soon.
He was a fucking kid.
He must never have gotten the shot. We have to tell Rose. We have to.
That was enough for Dan. He pulled the glove from her hand and threw it across the room. The piano ceased. The Hummels gave one final clatter and grew still, one of them on the verge of tumbling from the table. Dave was staring at his daughter with his mouth open. John had risen to his feet but seemed incapable of moving any further. Dan took Abra by the shoulders and gave her a hard shake. Abra, snap out of it! She stared at him with huge floating eyes.
Come back, Abra. It's okay.
Her shoulders, which had been almost up to her ears, gradually relaxed. Her eyes were seeing him again. She let out a long breath and fell back against her father's encircling arm. The collar of her t-shirt was dark with sweat.
Abby? Dave asked. Abadou? Are you all right?
Yes, but don't call me that.
She drew in air and let it out in another long sigh.
God, that was intense.
She looked at her father.
I didn't drop the F-bomb, Daddy. That was one of them. I think it was the Crow. He's the leader of the ones who are coming.
Dan sat down beside Abra on the couch. Sure you're okay?
Yes, now. But I never want to touch that glove again. They're not like us. They look like people, and I think they used to be people, but now they have lizardy thoughts.
You said Barry has measles. Do you remember that?
Barry, yes. The one they call the Chink. I remember everything. I'm so thirsty.
I'll get you water, John said.
No, something with sugar in it, please.
There are Cokes in the fridge, Dave said.
He stroked Abra's hair, then the side of her face, then the back of her neck, as if to reassure himself that she was still there. They waited until John came back with a can of Coke. Abra seized it, drank greedily, then belched.
Sorry,
she said, and giggled. Dan had never been so happy to hear a giggle in his life.
John, measles are more serious than adults, yes?
You bet. It can lead to pneumonia, even blindness due to corneal scarring.
Death?
Sure, but it's rare.
It's different for them, Abra said, because I don't think they usually get sick. Only Barry is. They're going to stop and get a package. It must be medicine for him. The kind you give in shots.
What did you mean about cycling?
Dave asked.
I don't know.
If Barry's sick, will that stop them? John asked. Will they maybe turn around and go back to wherever they came from?
I don't think so. They might already be sick from Barry, and they know it. They have nothing to lose and everything to gain. That's what Crow says.
She drank more Coke, holding the can in both hands, then looked around at each of the other men in turn, ending with her father.
They know my street, and they might know my name, after all. They might even have a picture. I'm not sure. Barry's mind is all messed up, but they think if I can't catch the measles...
Then your essence might be able to cure them, Dan said, or at least inoculate the others.
They don't call it essence. Abra said. They call it steam.
Dave clapped his hands once briskly. That's it. I'm calling the police. We'll have these people arrested.
You can't.
Abra spoke in the dull voice of a depressed 50-year-old woman.
Do what you want, that voice said. I'm only telling you.
He had taken his cell out of his pocket, but instead of opening it, he held it.
Why not?
They'll have a good story for why they're traveling to New Hampshire and lots of good identity things. Also, they're rich. Really rich. The way banks and oil companies and Walmart are rich. They might go away, but they'll come back. They always come back for what they want. They kill people who get in their way and people who try to tell on them. And if they need to buy their way out of trouble, that's what they do.
She put her Coke down on the coffee table and put her arms around her father.
Please, Daddy, don't tell anybody. I'd rather go with them than have them hurt Mom or you.
Dan said, but right now, there are only 4 or 5 of them.
Yes.
Where are the rest? Do you know that now?
At a place called the Bluebird Campground. Or maybe it's Bluebell. They own it. There's a town nearby. That's where the supermarket is, the Sam's. The town is called Sidewinder. Rose is there. And the True. That's what they call themselves. Dan, what's wrong?
Dan made no reply. For the moment, at least, he was incapable of speech. He was remembering Dick Halloran's voice coming from Eleanor Ouley's dead mouth. He had asked Dick where the empty devils were, and now the answer made sense. In your childhood.
Dan?
That was John. He sounded far away.
You're as white as a sheet.
It all made a weird kind of sense. He had known from the first, even before he actually saw it, that the Overlook Hotel was an evil place. It was gone now, burned flat, but who was to say the evil had also been burned away? Certainly not him. As a child, he had been visited by revenants who had escaped. This campground they own, it stands where the hotel stood. I know it. And sooner or later I'll have to go back there. I know that too. Probably sooner. But first...
I'm all right,
he said.
Want a Coke? Abra said. Sugar solves lots of problems, that's what I think.
Later. I have an idea. It's sketchy, but maybe the 4 of us working together can turn it into a plan.
6. Snakebite Andy parked in the trucker's lot of a turnpike rest area near Westfield, New York. Nut went into the service plaza to get juice for Barry, who was now running a fever and had a painfully sore throat. While they waited for him to come back, Crow put through a call to Rose. She answered on the first ring. He filled her in as quickly as he could, then waited.
"What's that I hear in the background?"
she asked. Crow sighed and rubbed one hand up a stubbled cheek.
That's Jimmy Numbers. He's crying.
Tell him to shut up. Tell him there's no crying in baseball.
Crow conveyed this, omitting Rose's peculiar sense of humor. Jimmy, at the moment wiping Barry's face with a damp cloth, managed to muffle his loud and, Crow had to admit it, annoying sobs.
That's better, Rose said.
What do you want us to do?
Give me a second. I'm trying to think.
Crow found the idea of Rose having to try to think almost as disturbing as the red spots that had now broken out all over Barry's face and body, but he did as he was told, holding the iPhone to his ear, but saying nothing. He was sweating. Fever? Or just hot in here? Crow scanned his arms for red blemishes and saw none. Yet.
Are you on schedule? Rose asked.
So far, yes. A little ahead, even.
There was a brisk double rap at the door. Andy looked out, then opened it.
Crow, still there?
Yes. Nut just came back with some juice for Barry. He's got a bad sore throat.
Try this, Walnut said to Barry, unscrewing the cap. It's apple, still cold from the cooler. It'll soothe your gullet something grand.
Barry got up on his elbows and gulped when Nut tipped the small glass bottle to his lips. Crow found it hard to look at.
He'd seen baby lambs drink from nursing bottles in that same weak, I-can't-do-it-myself way.
Can he talk, Crow? If he can, give him the phone.
Crow elbowed Jimmy aside and sat down beside Barry.
Rose, she wants to talk to you.
He attempted to hold the phone next to Barry's ear, but the chink took it from him. Either the juice or the aspirin Nut had made him swallow seemed to have given him some strength.
"Rose," he croaked. "Sorry about this, darling."
He listened, nodding.
"I know. I get that. I..."
He listened some more.
"No, not yet, but... yeah. I can. I will. Yeah. I love you, too. Here he is."
He handed the phone to Crow, then collapsed back onto the stacked pillows, his temporary burst of strength exhausted.
"I'm here," Crow said.
"Has he started cycling yet?"
Crow glanced at Barry.
"No."
"Thank God for small favors. He says he can still locate her. I hope he's right. If he can't, you'll have to find her yourselves. We have to have that girl."
Crow knew she wanted the kid. Maybe Julianne, maybe Emma, probably Abra, for her own reasons, and for him that was enough, but there was more at stake. Maybe the True's continued survival. In a whispered consultation at the back of the Winnebago, Nut had told Crow that the girl had probably never had the measles, but her steam might still serve to protect them because of the inoculation she would have been given as a baby. It wasn't a sure bet, but a hell of a lot better than no bet at all.
"Crow, talk to me, honey."
"We'll find her."
He shot the True's computer maven a look.
"Jimmy's got it narrowed down to 3 possibles, all in 1 block radius. We've got pictures."
"That's excellent."
She paused, and when she spoke again, her voice was lower, warmer, and perhaps the slightest bit shaky. Crow hated the idea of Rose being afraid, but he thought she was. Not for herself, but for the True Knot it was her duty to protect.
"You know, I'd never send you on with Barry sick if I didn't think it was absolutely vital."
"Yeah."
"Get her. Knock her the fuck out. Bring her back. Okay?"
"Okay."
"If the rest of you get sick, if you feel you have to charter a jet and fly her back..."
"We'll do that, too." But Crow dreaded the prospect. Any of them not sick when they got on the plane would be when they got off. Equilibrium shot, hearing screwed blue for a month or more, palsy, vomiting, and of course flying left.